Hello and welcome to Crosshairs Radio episode 23. On today's show, we have a return guest, Amanda Nauman, who was first on the show for episode 14. At that point, Amanda had just finished up her best weekend of UCI racing in Oklahoma and even laughed at me for suggesting that she might be racing World Cups by the end of the year. Well, we catch up with her after coming back from racing two World Cups in Europe and having a phenomenal season, great result at Nationals. It was a good cap on that first episode that we did. So if you haven't heard that, maybe worthwhile to go check out episode 14 and then come over here for episode 23. Either event, thanks so much for joining us. I'm going to get right into it. Here is Amanda Nauman. Hey, Amanda, how's it going?
Hi, Bill. I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing fine. So you enjoying your off season, relaxing, taking some time?
Yeah.
No, that's when you're
supposed to... Today is the first official day of the rest week, so I'm not going to ride my bike for the rest of the week.
Yeah. See, I was setting you up there to say, yeah, I stopped a race in cyclocross, and then I went out and raced 100 miles.
I did. Yeah, that's how we've kind of ended the cyclocross season for the past 3 years. One of the promoters out here always does a big gravel race at the beginning of February, and... we did it the first year and there were less than 100 people. And then this year there were over 300. So he's
cool.
Yeah, it's a fun time and we're all crazy because it's literally just a bunch of cyclocross racers from SoCal who think it's going to be a good idea to ride 100 miles at the end of cross season.
What's that transition like? I mean, you're putting in these incredibly hard 50-minute efforts and that's all you're really concentrating on. What's the most that you rode up until doing this?
It was so hard. But so I was doing a good amount of longer rides like right before I left for Oklahoma, so towards the end of November, those are probably the last long rides that I did for the rest of cross season. But as like last year was no problem. When I signed up for this race, it was like, I'm going to have a good block after Nationals. I had like 3 weeks where I could do some long rides and get ready for it. But this year, going to Europe took those 2 weeks away that I really needed. So, yeah, it definitely changed things. When I got back from Europe, I just had like 10 days maybe. And half of those days I squeezed in long rides just to try and get a little bit of fitness back. But I mean, it was nothing worth writing home about. I just tried to make sure I wasn't going to suffer too badly yesterday.
and make sure that you were first.
Yeah, I tried.
last year you went into that angry, and this year it was probably a little different mindset.
Exactly, yeah, that's very true. Last year I still had a chip on my shoulder about Austin, and this year, you know, my head was in a better place and I just kind of wanted to go out and have fun. And it was a good time, I think, just for me getting back because I hadn't been to any of the cross races that were here locally, like ever since I left for that Oklahoma trip. So in reality, I hadn't seen any of my friends that race cross and kind of the SoCal cross crowd since then. So it was a good time just to see everybody yesterday and at the same time suffer for 6 hours.
Yeah. So when we first talked, it was near the end of the season, but I think that you had just had sort of this breakout weekend in Oklahoma. And I was thinking, you know, sort of as this recap here at the end of the season, maybe we just start up from there. And I know that you've written some great POV columns that are up on cxairs.com that explain a lot of this, but really just sort of flesh out what happened after Oklahoma.
Okay. Yeah. So that was the first weekend of December was when we talked. So right after the Oklahoma races and it was the perfect time to talk. So I just won those two races there in Tulsa. And it was really, I think, good time for me in terms of looking at everything moving forward. And at that time, I wasn't even still, I don't think, in the top 100 of the rankings. Or I might have jumped into like around the 80s or so, but I remember you asked me in that interview, like, what about your thoughts on Europe and all this? And I laughed at you because still, even at that time, it was like so far-fetched to even consider. And then right after we did the interview, I drove down to Texas to do the two races, the Resolution Cross Cup in Garland, Texas. And I got third on the first day, and the second day it was a super heavy, muddy race. And that was kind of another big breakout race for me because I had never done that well in such terrible conditions. So it was a good learning experience. And at the same time, I kind of felt like I learned how to ride in those conditions a lot better. And I won on the second day. So that those points from getting the third on the first day and the first on the second day then pushed me into the 60s. So I was ranked 66th after that weekend. And still the concept of being in that top 50 wasn't on my radar. And then I spent the week in Waco, Texas, middle of December. And then the Highlander Cross Cup was the 19th and the 20th in Texas. And that was a great experience. I mean, I got to do some good training in Waco while I was down there. But at that point, we had been on the road for 2 weeks. And so I was kind of itching to go home. And I remember when we talked, like I had told you, like, well, if I'm not doing well or if I'm doing too well, I might just go home after the Resolution weekend. But at that point, I was like, okay, if I do well again and I stay down here and I actually get even more points, like that's going to keep pushing me up. So this is when I started doing some math on like, okay, if I do well here, I could start moving up in the rankings. And you know, whenever you see the potential to do something like that, then it's going to motivate you a bit more. So that was where my head was at going into Waco. And then the Waco weekend had a lot of the same girls who had stayed for the whole Southern Cross Cup series. There were some new girls that came and showed up to race. So it was still, I had no idea how it was going to finish. And that course was so fun. I mentioned in my write-up that the promoters there told me that when everybody woke up on Sunday morning and the whole chaos was ensuing about the course in Austin, Waco was actually on the table as a plan B just right, in case we weren't going to be able to race. So looking back on it now and seeing how awesome that course was, I mean, that is a great course as a potential for nationals caliber in terms of, you know, everything we saw in Asheville. Like there's a ton of climbing, but then at the same time you have descents that are technical and test kind of every skill set. So it was an awesome course and I loved it. And it didn't rain that all that much, but the course sits on the side of a hill where it drains underneath the hill basically. So at the bottom and kind of midway through on this course was just mud that sits there all the time because the rain from the upper levels of the hill kind of soak through the ground there. And the mud in Texas is just so different. Like even racing there and the mud that was in Austin, it's so hard to describe, but it's like this clayey, sandy sort of mud that gets everywhere in your rotors and there's no hiding from it basically.
Yeah, it's amazing how many different types of mud you realize there are. I remember talking to Wietse Bosemans up in Nittany earlier in the year, and he was like, the mud here is like nothing like it is in Belgium, you know. And he was like all like trying to figure out how to ride in that mud. It's just, yeah, that's the thing about cyclocross, you you learn all kinds of different types of mud.
Yeah, and like you could write a book on the different mud classifications of different courses. But yeah, so the Waco race went really well on the first day, and the second day I won both days, and it was a lot of climbing. And like in Asheville, there was the one super long climb before the mountain bike descent, right?
Right.
And it took about a minute from bottom to top, at least for the fastest girls. It was like 50 seconds to a minute. And it was the same thing in Waco. There was a full climb that took a whole minute. And on a course like that, you know, that's going to suit somebody who's very strong, right? And even watts per kilo are going to come into play on a course like that, because anytime you're going to climb for a full minute, it's really going to come down to how strong you are up that, no matter how technical the rest of the course is. So yeah, Waco went really well, and I started the drive home because we road trip out of that weekend. And on the drive back, I get a message from Scott Diedenbach, and he was like, you are in the top 50 in the UCI rankings. And I didn't believe him, because usually I check on Tuesdays, and he was messaging me this on a Monday night. So right, I was like, no, there's no way. So I looked it up, and sure enough, there I was, 48th. And like I said, I had no idea this was going to happen. And unfortunately, the consequences of me doing so well meant that Elle Anderson and Arlie Kemmerer were bumped out of the top 50. And this was literally like 5 days before the Zolder World Cup was going to happen on December 26th. Right. So,
I didn't even put that together, that, because I knew that that was that crazy thing where they weren't able to race, but I didn't put it together. It was like your success led to their inability to race.
Yeah. And it sucks. I, as happy as I was, it's the unfortunate circumstances, because, you know, the USA Cycling rules on applying for a World Cup, like, they have their own rules. But then the UCI also has their own set of rules on those countries putting in their, their registrations for that actual race. So, for example, USAC says, you know, you have to have your World Cup entry in 3 weeks before the date of the actual race, and then 2 weeks before they're going to give the final team, whatever. But really, that doesn't matter, because the UCI says whatever the rankings are the Tuesday before that race, you know, the Monday, Tuesday, whenever they come out, like the 5 or 6 days before the race, if you're in the top 50 then that's when you like, that's your final confirmation. Which is crazy,
right?
Because some, like, in Arlie and Elle's case, they're already over there.
Right.
And
it's fine if you live in France.
Yeah, exactly.
Or Belgium. Where, mm-hmm. Making all those plans, spending all that money to go over there, and then being told you can't race.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what the solution to that is, though.
I've read a couple comments on it. I think Adam Meyerson has the best solution, that UCI just needs to kind of push back that final deadline for the rankings that are like 2 weeks before, not
right.
The week of.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, and so. Because all of this happened, it kind of snowballed into this bigger picture discussion on, you know, USAC's registration deadlines and the UCI's. And then I talked to Helen Wyman and asked her opinion on all of this, because not only was I kind of creating the situation, but it was going to happen to me in, you know, a month from then if I actually wanted to go to Europe and race in some of the World Cups that were after Nationals. So because all this happened, I was totally aware that now that I was in the top 50, I technically had the opportunity to go, but there's a really good chance that in the next 2 weekends I was going to get bumped out of the top 50. So even if I bought plane tickets, committed to going, there was still a good chance that I wasn't going to be in the top 50 anymore, the 1-2 weeks leading up to that race in France.
Right. God, it's just insane. But at the same time, it's just also insane that would you have ever thought a year ago in that same situation that you'd be in this whole situation
predicament.
Yeah.
No, and that's like I said, even when I talked to you at the beginning of December, I didn't think I was going to be, because like before that Oklahoma race weekend, I was ranked 138th, you know, even, and at that point in time, all those girls were probably planning for those European trips, and somebody like me wouldn't even have been on the radar of like, oh, she's probably going to break into the top 50. There's no way. So yeah, it's just, it was happy times, but also, you know, questioning a lot of things and feeling bad at the same time, but also like, well, this could be a good opportunity for me, but not really if I don't get into the top 50 once January rolls around. So yeah,
right.
It's been a good learning experience, but I hope that, I guess my story kind of makes people more aware of how significant the ranking system is and how complicated it can be. And I think more so just for the women's side, because we have so many strong women who end up in the top 50. And because our field is so competitive over here, at any point in time, we could have 12, 13 girls that are actually in the top 50. but there are more girls, let's say, that want to go race in Europe. So everything becomes a waiting game of like, well, if there are 8 girls that are registered, there can't be any more. It has to be just the girls are in the top 50. Like, there's so many more issues that we have to deal with now because our field is so strong and much deeper. And the only other nation that really has to worry about that right now is the men's Belgian team, because they're in the same boat where they have a ton of guys who are vying for those nationals and world spots. And they're, I think, probably the only ones that have to deal with this like we do, because they're always battling each other.
Sure. Yeah. And it's nuts with them, because even when there are U23 races, if there weren't, they'd have like 20 guys who are eligible, you know. Thankfully, some of them go race U23. But on the flip side, it is interesting that rule change that happened, you know, the beginning of last year really mm-hmm. benefits U.S. women. And that's pretty cool. You know, it is the situation that you were in, and the situation that Arlie and, you know, those guys over there got themselves into stinks. But at the same time, it's pretty neat that there are opportunities for all of these U.S. women to be able to race by being in the top 50.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, we're probably going to see a lot of things change in the next couple years if North American World Cups stick around. You know, it's just those opportunities are there now for us to race here, but also, you know, be able to go over to Europe and do some of those World Cups if you want to. And it's just going to become so much more of a point game, as much as I hate that, just because the World Cups have so many more points available. And yeah, it's just cyclocross is very interesting when you look at it solely by the numbers.
Yeah, and this is something I wanted to talk about later, but you know, since we're discussing it now, you got yourself in a couple conversations about that, especially once the schedule for next year came up, and we have once again 40 plus UCI races in the US plus 2 World Cups, and there are weekends where there will be 3 C2 races in different regions of the country. And it, you know, I mean, you, the way you scheduled yourself this year, and, you know, some people questioned it and you defended yourself great, whether it's, you know, sort of searching out points and going to the races that you think you can do well in. And that's, I mean, that's even more going to be the case next year, right?
Yeah, I think so. But that's the case, I think, with everybody. And it was so hard for me to grasp the word cherry picking, I guess, to use it to describe that, because it's like, it's just strategizing. And that's how it is for everybody, whether you're Jeremy Powers racing only a C1 on a weekend where there's 2 races because that's the best decision for him. Like, everybody does that, you know, and every racer is going to do what's best for them, whether that goal is racing the fastest women in the field because you want to better yourself that way, or whether that is going to a C2 weekend where there are going to be less competitors there and you have a better chance of winning. Like, it's all strategy, and that's such a big part of cyclocross. And it's like, not everybody's going to have the opportunity to go to all the C1 weekends, like, mostly just on cost alone. So,
right. And I think also, you know, going back to the discussion I had with Meyerson on this, is that we have such a huge landmass, if you broke us up into different countries, like, nobody gives Francis Moret a hard time this year for avoiding Belgium and racing in Switzerland the whole time and getting all of his UCI points there so when the world championship came around, he still was in that, you know, first or second row. Even though you never saw him in Belgium. I mean, it's the exact same thing, but nobody's questioning that. But here, since we're all the same country, it seems like somehow that's different. Whereas mm-hmm. you can do more of a regional schedule, and that's really where we're getting at. You know, we're going to see that next year. I mean, I'm dealing with myself as, you know, one of the co-promoters for DCCX, where we are up against Cleveland, which isn't that far away. So now mm-hmm. we have these two sort of regional, you know, people are really going to have to choose. Yeah, and I think cherry picking certainly not the right word for that. You go where you think you're going to do the best.
Yeah, exactly. And even like when I was listening to the podcast with this, the follow up one that you did with Ben, and he was talking about not being able to go to Jingle Cross. It's like he literally just couldn't afford it, you know. And of course he would want to go and race the best guys. Like, who wouldn't if you had the opportunity to? But I think everybody who's kind of fumbling around in spots 5 through 20 in the rest of the field. Like, it's just such a different ball game. And we have to remember that kind of everybody's just doing the best they can to get, you know, whatever results and goals they're looking for.
Right. I'm glad you listened to that one with Ben Fredericks. I really think that the two of you sort of have followed pretty similar paths this year. And it's actually that of this cyclocross season, especially doing this podcast and everything, that was one of the most exciting things for me, just seeing both of y'all have just these awesome breakout years and really looking forward to see what next year brings.
Yeah. It's the first time, because you interviewed Ben before I did my first podcast with you. And I remember listening to it, and it was like, there's so many parallels here. There's so many things that he's done and that's trying to do. And that a lot of times, like, that story never gets told. You know, everybody always wants to interview the guys that are on the podium all the time. You get these great perspectives from the top of the field and people who have support. But in reality, everybody that's listening to those people who are getting first, second, third all the time, you know, most of us are the people in the rest of the field that are like, oh, I really want to get there. But a lot of times, like, you never hear the story of the people who work towards getting there. And I think that was where we resonated with a lot of people in the United States, fans, amateur racers, whatever you want to call it, because we're the reflection of that person that ultimately has bigger dreams, right? And we're trying to do that and get there. So I think it was cool for me to listen to Ben and then me do the interview. And then, like, literally 2 months later, we're kind of rolling into nationals with these epic results and just such feel-good stories. And I think it was probably my favorite thing from the season was being able to share that, I guess, development with everyone.
Yeah, it's been awesome. And listen to this for a segue. Speaking of stories not told, I think in our last time when we first talked, there was one that we didn't have time for about you coming up and sort of getting into the sport that I think we should go back and revisit now.
Okay. Yeah. So there was one story I regretted not telling when we first did the podcast and kind of, you know, mountain biking and leading into cross and all that. So when I was 22, I think, I was racing mountain bikes on an amateur level here locally, and I went to nationals, and they were in Pennsylvania that year, and I won cross-country nationals for the 19 to 24 age group. So I was a national champion. It was awesome, and that was what prompted me to, I guess, focus more on racing elite for that cyclocross season. So that was when, you know, two months later, I did Cross Vegas, and that kicked off everything with cross. But then, fast forward to April 2014, after my awesome cross season, I was like, I'm going to get my pro card mountain biking. I was already national champion as an amateur, so naturally, you know, I should move up and keep pushing myself. So I did a couple races at the elite level. The U.S. Cups at that point in time had just been turned over to Scott Tedrow. So he had just taken control of those. There were some awesome races. I had some pretty good results, and I signed up for the Sea Otter cross-country race that was in April. And in typical over-eager Amanda fashion, I was, like, super excited about this race to a bad level, like, too excited. So at the start of the race, if anybody's been to Sea Otter before, you know, most of all the races, even the mountain biking ones, start in that racetrack arena. So we made a loop around that, went up the hill, and the first giant descent that you do on that course is just a big gravel, super steep fire road. And it had rained the week leading up to kind of all the events that were happening that week. And so there were some pretty big rain ruts that were going down this descent. And I, during pre-ride, I was, you know, doing it fine. You're supposed to stay on the left side. It's vividly ingrained in my brain at this point. And so the race started, and I was doing great. And one of the reasons why Amanda was super overeager is because Marianne Vos was in the race.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so she came out, and Katarina Nash was in the race. Like, this is clearly by far the most epic field of women that I've ever raced in. And you know, at the start, I'm like, okay, I'm going to try and get up there. And I can see Vos and Nash, and I'm probably at this point, like, in the top 12 going into this descent. But I'm biting off more than I can chew, and I go down on the right side instead of the left, and the right side is where the rain ruts were, and I crashed so badly. And it was, I was lucky because there was an ambulance that had actually been parked right there, because I guess there had been issues at that spot previously in the week. And so I went over the bars, smashed my head in the ground. Luckily, the guy ran over immediately. But the crazy part about the story is that when I smashed my head in the ground, I landed face first, and I actually broke one of my front teeth. And at the time, you know, it just happened. I cracked my tooth. The guy came over and he was asking me questions, and I wasn't answering them correctly. So I had a minor concussion. And they took me to the hospital, you know, started the recovery process, and that's all fine. I was, you know, I took some time off the bike. It was a pretty big deal. At least mentally, you know, you start questioning, like, why am I doing this? If, like, the risks that are involved can be so expensive, so time consuming, all this stuff. But anyways, the best part of this story is that 2 months later, I sign up for a race, that was in Big Bear, California. So another mountain bike race, and I'm feeling better. I'd started training again. I was like, I'm just going to get out there and do this and try and, you know, shake it off. So I did the race and I did okay, but on the drive home, if you've ever raced at altitude before and it's dusty, you get these big, like, coughs, and a lot of times you're coughing up stuff because you're just, you know, there's extra phlegm, whatever. And I'm driving home, and I kid you not, like, this is a story that I needed to tell. I coughed my tooth up that I had broken.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And it's funny because that story defined me for a good few months after that, because people just remembered me as the girl who coughed her tooth up, because so what happened was, when I face planted, the tooth, like, broke off and I inhaled it really quickly and it lodged in the back of my throat. But when I did, like, the head or I never did a chest x-ray. It was just, a CAT scan for my head after it happened.
Right.
So there was nothing for a doctor to say, like, oh, that's weird. But I remember telling one of the doctors that I went to after I came back, like, I have this weird wheezing when I breathe in deeply. And he was like, oh, it's probably nothing. But, like, it was my tooth in my throat. And, like, I've told different doctors this story ever since then. And still to this day, it's, like, the weirdest story they've ever heard. But
that's insane. Yeah. Wow.
I mean, well, it's cool. It's a cool story, though, because it's, like, the human body is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
That there was a foreign object in me, and it took 2 months to eventually get out, but the fact that it happened is pretty bizarre.
Well, that, and at least now there are other things to define you by than, yeah, than the girl that coughed up her tooth.
Yeah, exactly. No, but seriously, I was going, like, that cross season later, when I was going to races, people were like, oh, aren't you the girl that coughed her tooth up? yeah, that was me.
So, you know, that is an amazing story. What's funny is about that is, as you were talking, I quickly went back into my photo archives, because I was the USA cycling photographer for Bear Creek mountain bike. I was like looking at the podium shops and like, oh, yep, there you are.
Yeah. Yep, that was me.
You were, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was, what'd you think of that course, like having ridden or raced on the West Coast and then coming to the East Coast?
Oh my God. That it was a nightmare. I got there.
That was every California person and all the East Coast people were loving it every time, yeah, one of them said it.
And it's so funny because I really had no idea what I was getting into, because I had been racing mountain bikes for like 4 or 5 months. And I was like, yeah, nationals, let's just go and do it. And I got there, and in typical East Coast fashion, it's just, you know, raining every afternoon, right? So we get there, a little tiny rainstorm blows through. We're like, okay, let's just get on the course and do a lap. And like 10 minutes into the lap, I'm crying because I don't know how to ride this stuff. And it's like, if you're a really good racer in California and you go try and ride those rocks in Pennsylvania, it's just a completely different level of mountain biking. There's different skills involved. Right. It's so different. And I joked after the race, I was like, I learned how to ride a mountain bike after my race at Nationals that year, because it was like, that was mountain biking, you know? What I was doing in California was a little bit dustier and drier and a lot of fire roads and just so different. And yeah, I was, I learned how to ride a mountain bike in Pennsylvania.
Yep. As you know, Pennsylvania rocks. That's what I like to say.
For sure. Someday I'll do the Transylvania Epic and go back and tackle that.
Yeah, that would be great. So back to present day. One question I have for you. When you're going through this Oklahoma and then Texas stretch and you started, you know, racing in September, how are you feeling at that point? Do you feel like you're still getting stronger or are you starting to wear down? I mean, you still have nationals ahead and then, you know, we'll get to even going to Europe, but where are you at physically in those races?
I had a little bit slower start to the season because I didn't actually race a UCI race until Providence. And that was, I think, the last weekend of September, or beginning of October. So it was a little bit different for me because I wasn't so, I guess, caught up in racing from the beginning. Like, I didn't do Rochester, and that was 4 or 5 weeks before that. So I was doing okay. I got in that crash at Louisville, and then when I came home, I did CXLA, and I had, like, a good two-and-a-half-week block of really good training at the end, like, right around Thanksgiving time. And then I left to Oklahoma and Texas. And looking back on it, like, I was in a great place, like, physically, and I think that that's kind of the biggest difference between me at that point in time and everybody else. Like, Elle Anderson had a later start, so she was kind of in the same boat where she was, you know, peaking around December. But I guess training-wise and everything, that was kind of the plan all along, was to do well in that Southern Series. But I think looking back on it, that was a detriment to me, you know, a month later in January, because I was more focused on doing well in the Southern races. And like I told you, after Oklahoma, like, nationals wasn't even that big of a goal for me.
Sure.
So the plan was for me to get home after Texas and kind of figure out that last 2 weeks of December, kind of play it by ear, because I wasn't kind of ready to address nationals or anything like that. I wanted to get those points out of the way in Texas. But yeah, from a training standpoint and everything, I think it was just planned really well. And it was the first year that I had done it this way, where I didn't really want to start racing until the beginning of October. So
right. And now I'm assuming after your success from, you know, where we'll pick up, that is going to affect how you schedule next season, since I would assume that you are expecting to be racing longer into the year even than you did this year.
Yeah, and even earlier. That's the problem.
Sure, because you have those World Cups, right. So yeah.
Yeah.
So that's almost like a month extra on each end.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so next year's going to be completely different,
right?
Because
it's almost doing sort of that European schedule where those guys take a race or two off in the middle of the season, and you know, but yeah, no, that's it's interesting. It's going to be I think to go back and look at your data and look at what you did and have to revamp it again, but you know, at least it's a positive challenge this year.
Yeah, definitely. And it's like, when we talked the last time, you know, I mentioned I don't have very good snap, like my high end isn't that good, but all the races that I did well at, like Providence, for example, I was doing a lot of that high end stuff leading up to just for that race, because I wanted to kind of come in with a bang since I wasn't doing any of those earlier races. So then, you know, leading into nationals, I kind of re-emulated what I had done leading up to Providence a few months before. So I guess it's learning things like that of how, you know, typically I have a good engine, like at threshold, I can do that work for like good chunks of time. But then if you ask me to do those efforts that go way above threshold, like 30, 40 times in a race, it's hard to then go back and like maintain that threshold on the rest of the course. So it's been a learning process this year of trying to figure that out, that balance of like making sure I still have the engine, but also being able to have that snap when I need it.
Right. Yeah. No, and I just, you know, even talking to Powers, that's the same thing that he, I don't know if struggles is the right word, but tries to find that balance in that, he, you know, especially racing in Europe where it's a totally different style than the U.S. For U.S. races, I think you need more of that snap since you're coming out of more corners on these courses. You know, as we talked about last time when you came into Nationals last year, it was pretty much your A race. That was your goal, was doing well in Nationals. This year, it seemed like it was a B, if not C goal for you. You weren't putting any expectations on yourself. So after Texas, where do we go from there, and how do you get to Asheville?
So after Texas, I was kind of still in the same mindset where I was taking a little bit more of a laid back approach to Nationals. I didn't want to put too much pressure on myself, but instead of me saying that because I just didn't, I wanted to have a laid back Nationals, now I was saying it because there was this looming possibility of Europe behind it. And then all of a sudden I wanted to do well at Nationals because I wanted to get those points from that race.
Right.
So
that it's sort of funny that it became, last year it was, I want to do well at Nationals to prove I can do well at Nationals. This year it's this more analytical, a lot of points in national championships. This is where I have to do well so I can maybe reach these higher goals.
Yeah, exactly. And so that stress kind of elevated a little bit more than I wanted it to. Mostly because, the Monday, Tuesday before Nationals, I then got ranked 53rd. So I got bumped out of the top 50 right leading into that race. And so I was telling myself, I need these points now. So, the stress escalated pretty quickly the few days leading up to it because, 2 weeks before, I had actually sent in my applications to USA Cycling to ask to race the World Cups in France and Hoogerheide. So when I had sent that in, USA Cycling got back to me and was like, you might be able to race France. You're probably not going to be able to race Hoogerheide because it's the weekend before Worlds and all the girls are going to be over there before that. So really, in my head, there was not a very good chance of me going. And then the Saturday night, I think that afternoon before Nationals, I got an email from USA Cycling that said not all the girls are going to take their starting spots for the French World Cup and that I had the opportunity to go and do that if I wanted to. So it's literally the night before I get this email. And then all that stress that I put on myself for doing well at Nationals, I was like, well, it doesn't really matter because now I'm going to go anyways, regardless of whether or not I get points that bumps me into the top 50, right? So, it was a roller coaster of emotions leading up to that race. But I knew starting at Nationals that no matter what happened, I was going to get on a plane to Europe in the next two or three days.
And in your back of your head, were you still thinking Hoogerheide?
Yes, I was because I knew, but just points-wise, because I had no points, no World Cup points in my category of points, right? You have buckets that you fill, and my World Cup bucket has zero. So if I was going to get any points in France, that was going to push me up, and I'd have a very good chance of getting in the top 50. I knew Hoogerheide was probably going to still stay there.
Right. That's an interesting point, too, that I don't think everybody grasps about those buckets. For instance, with the C2s, eventually that bucket gets filled, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you can't get any more points in that. And that's what some of that sort of goes into that Powers thinking, I'm only going to do C1s because he'll max out his C2s right away and then it's not worth it to race those.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, it's a nice problem to have, but mm-hmm. but that's sort of a level of it that I think people listening don't always grasp. But all of these different races mean different things points wise.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think that was the reason why I had such a good head on my shoulders the morning of Nationals, because I knew it was a nothing matters situation, it was I'm gonna put this all on the line because it doesn't matter. I'm going to Europe after this, and that I knew I was going to get more points and that was going to make more of an impact on next season than whatever place I got at Nationals. So, do you want to talk about Nationals now?
I would love to talk about Nationals now. Do you think that It's interesting. So I don't know. It's sort of that mixed bag, I guess, coming in there. You say you didn't have pressure, but you still had pressure, but I guess it was more positive. It wasn't, yeah. There wasn't that negative energy going into nationals.
Yeah. Right. It was less like I have something to prove and more of like, I'm just going to give it my all and prove that, you know, I can be at the front of the race. And so, yeah, that was the mindset that I had leading into it, which I think was good. And I got a second row call up, which was the farthest forward I've ever been at a nationals race. I think in Boulder, I was fourth row. Last year, I was maybe third or fourth row. So yeah, being on the second row and kind of not only that, but I was the second pick on the second row. So Georgia had the first pick and then I could choose, you know, at that point you get basically any spot you want on right. that second row. And that's kind of a big deal because then you can pick, you know, who in front of you is going to do well. Who do you want to start behind?
Absolutely.
So,
yeah. And it was also, you know, with that left-hand turn at the end, I'm assuming you didn't want to be over to the left-hand side of that starting grid.
Right. And I remember when you asked Ben that question and he was like, yeah, it's hard because you wanted to be on the right. But then you're like, what if you're that guy that gets the last row on that or the last pick on that row and you don't want to be over there? Like, I've actually been in situations before where I've done that. Even if I'm the last pick of the row, like, I'll still choose where I want to be, even if that means the next row back. Because it's just, especially that nationals course, like, that left-hand turn was for sure going to pinch people off, right? If you were inside that, you were going to have to slow down, pretty much guaranteed.
But at the same time, it's... It was a long starting yeah. stretch to yeah, get to that yeah, left-hand turn. You know, not saying that that's any different, but I was just looking at it like, man, that's an all-out effort just to yeah. get to that turn.
Yeah, and oh my God, that start was how every start should be because I'm a little bit biased because I've crashed on a flat, fast starting stretch before, so I think they're more dangerous. But the grade on that nationals course was just perfect enough where it demanded more energy for the starting strip. And it demanded, like, less of, oh, my God, I want to avoid a crash, and more of, like, I'm going to try and get as far forward as I can. And there's a little bit of a grade, so it's going to, I guess, spread the field out more than a flat start would have. So I started behind Katie Antineau. And I was the third over on the right side. And my start was the best start I've ever had in my entire life. But yeah, luckily there are pictures of it. So I can look back. And it wasn't just all in my head. Because I swear, in that moment, I was like, there's no way this is happening right now. But there's proof that it happened. So yeah, I started. And I don't know, Katie Compton moved left. Katie Antineau just started moving left, and all of a sudden there was just this open space in front of me,
and I could
just go. And I don't know how to describe that feeling of being able to have that opportunity to just go. Like in every single cross race that you're starting, unless you're on the front row, it's never just go. It's only go for the front row. And you're going, if you're on row two, you're going, but still navigating, right? You still have to make sure that there's, you know, you're not going to crash. There's not somebody that's going to swing into you on the left or the right side. So it's a hard feeling to describe because I've never had that opportunity before unless it, you know, I started on the front row in the races in Texas. So I had, you know, the get up and go mentality, but never in a field where I was like, I have always dreamed of being able to just start with those girls, you know, and that was the first time that I had that chance and that open space in front of me. Like, I don't know, it's hard to describe, but it was like the golden opportunity that I needed, especially on that course. So I just went for it. And we go around that left-hand corner, and Courtney McFadden and Katie Compton are the only two girls that I can see in my peripheral vision that are right next to me and just barely ahead. And that course had that double ditch bump that happened, you know, 20 seconds in after the first corner.
Right.
And so I knew that had caused issues earlier in the day in some of the other categories. And talking strategy, there were two different lines you could take to go kind of perpendicular to those bumps and make sure there is an off-camber line that is faster, right? And you can take that chance if you want to. But does it make sense right at the start when there's like 30 other girls around you? No. So as we come around under the flyover, I just went for it. And all of a sudden, I'm leading. So I'm like, well, the thing that's coming up next is a double ditch bump. So I'm just going to keep going because I don't want anybody around me when we hit that. So I just kept going and going. And all of a sudden, I'm still leading through the whole thing. And my mind is racing. And like, it was so hard for me to put this into words when it was happening because I didn't know what to do. We go over the next flyover and are by the pits. And at this point, I realize that David is probably freaking out because it's a minute into the race and I'm leading it over this flyover. And I probably shouldn't be there, but I am. And so we come around the next two corners. And when I wrote about it in my race report, like mentally, I had already won. This was like all I really wanted to do was make a statement at this race, and I had done it. But it was kind of a bad thing that I thought that because, like, as I came around the next corner, like, I kid you not, what was happening in my brain, I was like, ah, I can't mess up Katie if she's behind me.
Right, I can't
mess up. Like, all I was worried about was the person behind me instead of me worrying about my own race.
Right, and still not putting it, – it's still almost that imposter mentality that you don't belong there.
Yeah, exactly.
And you do, yeah, and that you should just be racing your race.
Yeah, so I went around the next two corners and up to the run-up, and I didn't mentally check out at that point. I was just like, the guy on my shoulder that was telling me I didn't belong there was just winning a little bit, so I let Elle Anderson go by me, Katie Compton went by me, and then when she passed me so close to me that I almost went off the course into a bush. And that was kind of the moment where I was like, okay, I need to get my head in the game because this is an actual race, Amanda. Like, you didn't just get to the front doing nothing, right? You need to actually work for this now that you're there. So, yeah, and the rest of the race just kind of turned into maintaining. And I was fighting with Rachel Lloyd and Becca Farringer for most of the race. Rachel Lloyd pulled away because she was just consistently faster in a few sections every lap. And Becca Farringer had a freaking amazing race. And I don't know how to describe it, but she just nailed it. And she had been racing well all season, and everything just came together for her on that day. And I kept telling myself, like, you can catch her. And I just was not catching her in any of the sections that I was, you know, trying to put more of an effort to try and get closer to her. But yeah, so as the last lap rolled around and I'm cramping on every run up and wondering if I'm even going to maintain seventh place, I just kind of tried to stay as focused as I could. And Amanda Miller and Meredith Miller were gaining on me pretty good on that last lap. And luckily I just kept everything upright and pushed as hard as I could and somehow came through top 10 at Nationals.
Yeah, just really, really great ride and just an amazing, not even end to the season, but just sort of cap, I guess, on the U.S. season for you.
Yeah, yeah, and it was just good. Like, it took me a lot longer to write that race report because I got sick after Nationals, but I think it was good that I had as much time as I did to write on it and reflect on it a little bit more because it went so back and forth from like, I don't care about Nationals to, oh my God, I care too much for the points. And then, yeah, so kind of to have everything wrap up in that moment, like as soon as I finished the race, it was just like, I was just happy. And that was the best way to describe it. So it was a good day.
Yeah, it was great. And then you got bonus races.
I did. Yeah. So, I mean, like, back to your question about the training and everything, like, everything had been planned to, like, do well at Nationals, and that Europe trip was just going to be a bonus, right? So whatever my fitness was at Nationals, it was just all about maintaining it, kind of, for France and Hoogerheide. And, yeah, it was kind of a good and bad thing, because right after Nationals, I got sick. And I don't know if this was a more widespread thing, but in that moment, I thought it was isolated, just me and food poisoning. But after I got to France and I found out Steven Hyde wasn't racing because he got sick, I sent a message to him and he was like, yeah, some sort of stomach virus, and apparently more people than just you and I got it.
So I knew so many people who got sick right before or at Nationals. It was, yeah.
And I guess, I don't know, we were just all like in tight quarters. I don't know when it happened, but at some point I picked something up and it just freaking to the ground on Monday. And I spent Monday night in the bathroom. But what sucked is that, like, I spent all of Monday morning planning this trip to Europe, right? I'm like on cloud nine. I'm stoked about everything. I get the plane tickets. I spend all this money on the hotel rooms. And all of a sudden, I'm like wiped out on the floor of the bathroom for the entire night. And so I wake up the next morning thinking I'm screwed because I had just like committed all this time and money towards a trip. And like one little thing just completely ruined my body for the past 12 hours. So all of a sudden I was super stressed out about it. I didn't even know if I wanted to go anymore. I was like, I don't think it's worth it if I can't even ride my bike this week. So it was so hard to deal with mentally and physically because I didn't ride my bike until Friday once we were actually there. So I took Monday afternoon all the way through Friday off my bike. And I was throwing up the whole time. Like, it wasn't the ideal situation leading up to my first World Cup. So it was such a roller coaster of events, but we made it there. I rode my bike on Friday in France. Things were looking up. And then we went and pre-rode the course on Saturday. And I was like, okay, I think I can do this.
Yeah, but you probably, I mean, yeah, granted, just from that whole season, you know, the whole Nationals experience and then getting sick and then the travel and everything, you could not have been going in there 100%, but at least you were at least feeling better by the time the race started, and you got to go to a World Cup of a cyclocross race, which was,
I know,
pretty cool.
and that's the part that I kept telling myself. It was like I was so worried about the racing at that point that I had to take a step back, and after I rode on Friday, it was like, this is central France, and I'm riding my bike right now. Like, you just have to kind of take a step back every once in a while and be like, it's not the end of the world. It's going to be okay. No matter what happens, you're actually racing a World Cup. So,
And then you get a World Cup experience that is almost like an American course.
Exactly. And not only that, but it was a World Cup experience, that would have been kind of, I guess, equivalent to Vegas, right? Because it's not in Belgium or the Netherlands. It's somewhere completely different that everybody is traveling to, not
right.
just
exactly, yeah.
the Americans. So, yeah, it kind of put everybody on a level playing field because everybody had to travel to get there, which was nice. But I also learned there that kind of sugar-coated things that weekend for me before Hoogerheide, because it was like the French were super nice. They were very welcoming. And I had heard stories that, you know, the Belgians are much more strict about wearing the wristbands that say you can go to the pit or not, or the start finish area. Like, they're just a little bit more harsh on the Americans. Whereas in France, it was like, oh yeah, just, you know, go wherever you want. You can do whatever. So, in that sense, it was good, because I got, you know, a nicer perspective at that World Cup. But it was, yeah, the course was not my favorite. Very twisty, turny. I haven't even watched the replay of that race, just because everything was so busy afterwards. But I don't know how it looked on camera, but
I don't know if I've watched it. It just seemed, I don't know, it didn't seem like a whole lot of fun, and it was...
Yeah, no, it wasn't. And like, I love courses where I can go for it, right? Like, if there are power sections, if there's a good climb, whatever the case may be. And that course had one of those sections. And it was so hard to start the race. And I was literally running from the first corner for, like, the next, I want to say, like, 2 minutes I was running. And it was just so frustrating because it was like, this isn't even a race. I'm not racing. I'm just like navigating through people who are sliding around on off cambers. And yeah, so it was difficult because, you know, in contrast to Nationals where it was like second row.
Right, exactly. You know, you were back in the scrum again.
Yes, exactly. And it was like all that work, you know, you do all that work to get to the front of the race domestically. You go over to Europe and you're just thrown into the masses again, and you have to basically start from ground zero, and it's so frustrating. But it was a good experience because I think I needed that kick in the face of like, well, this is how it's going to be if you want to get to the next level, and you're just going to have to suck it up. And so at the start of that race, Elle Anderson and I had started on the same row, and so we went kind of into all those corners where everybody's running together. So she was right in front of me. In my mind, mentally, I was like dead last in that race, and the fact that she had been like right there with me the whole time was good for me mentally, because I was like, okay, well, if Elle Anderson's there, then it's not the end of the world. I'll be all right. So I followed her as much as I could on that first lap, and then she took off. But yeah, the rest of that race was kind of just moving up as much as I could. And the cool thing about the start finish banners, or whatever you want to call it, gates in Europe, is that they have your placing, how many seconds back you are from the leader.
Oh, so that's just like that huge LCD up there.
Yeah, and so when you're watching the races here, you see that, right? And it's kind of nice for the fans because you can find out where everybody is in relation to each other. But when you're racing, it's like the coolest thing ever to know where you actually are, especially when it's a field that deep. So I knew I was moving up every lap, and that's like a huge
Yeah,
motivation.
and that's a great point, because when you're in the middle of a pack in a US race, unless you got somebody working for you in the pits, but you know, most amateurs don't even have that. You have no idea. And yeah,
Exactly.
you're just sort of
Yeah.
like,
Yeah, and it's not even where you are, if you like cross in 30th, you're like, okay, I'm 30th, but you
the
know that the
time.
leader is 2 minutes ahead of you or whatever, you know. And so it's kind of nice. And that was a good that was good for me in that race because I was moving up every lap and I finished 28th. But when I came through on the first lap, I was probably like 38th, 39th or something. So yeah, that was all I was trying to do in that race, was move up as much as I could. And
Always good to be moving forward.
yeah, and I think I mentioned it in my write-up, but the girl that I was racing with for a majority of that race, she had a kit on that said France on it. And so I looked her up after the race because she sprinted past me just at the end and got 27th. And I was like, holy crap, this girl is 19. And then I'm looking at the results, and there were 10 girls, I think, ahead of me that were under the age of 23.
Yeah, because you were right around Nyjah Heigl as well. The
And so you think, like, oh, yeah, 28th at a World Cup, not bad. And it's also not bad considering if the U23 women had their own race, I would have been 18th, you know, in the teens. So it kind of got me thinking of like what would happen in the future if the U23 women got their own World Cup event, you know, if they had their own category to race in. I don't know if that's ever going to happen, but
Hope
it
it does.
definitely changes the way the fields happen, much in the same way that the U23 men kind of have their own thing of racing, but it also affects the bigger picture of the UCI point rankings in a very different way.
And it's the same. The same thing happens in both the men and the women, where you're like, well, they're 19, but they're really fast. That same thing happens in the men now too. I mean, you look at the fastest men out there; they're all, under 24 years old.
So it was cool, and it's good to see. Like, that was the first time I was like seriously looking at this World Cup result sheet and saying like there are a lot of girls who are coming up that are U23 that are going to be super fast, you know. And it's a great thing that this U23 category was going to happen at World Championships, because they were going to get this own their stage to do their thing and show everybody that they are super fast and they're going to be a force to reckon with in the next 10 years.
And it's exciting racing. That's always my point. It's like, why shouldn't we have more races? And especially in World Cups, where there's not, our problem domestically is always there are too many fields. It's always squeezing in more fields. We want to have a, especially UCI races, you want to have a U19, but then there's not enough time to do the amateurs, and that's what's paying the bills. The World Cups don't have that problem. They're only, what, five races in at the World Championships. So yeah, there's room for more.
Yeah, absolutely.
They could put three on each day, and then they would have 4 hours of drinking for the world championship.
That's such a mess.
So that is a positive experience. Then you worked your way up, good result. And so at that point, when do you know that you're able to, or what is the conversation that happens with USA Cycling to get into Hoogerheide?
I'm pretty sure. I think it might have happened the next day. I don't know. I'd have to check my email, but I think it was Gullickson emailing me the next day that he already knew everybody's travel schedule for Worlds and who is going to come over early or whatnot. And so Courtney McFadden kind of was the only one that he wasn't expecting to come over that decided to come over after Nationals. But for example, Crystal Anthony wasn't coming over for Hoogerheide. She was only going to World. So there were a couple spots that were opening up where it was only X amount of people that were going to be registered. But it didn't matter because after the French race, I did end up 47th in the ranking. So that pushed me up. And no matter what had happened, I would have still been able to race. I would plan for that. The only issue was the rental car. But I figured it out and we were able to extend it and then book the hotel rooms.
The car that you had in France, just being able to keep that one and
yeah, on over exactly. It seems like such an insignificant detail, but when you've got three bike bags and you're trying to figure out how to travel with them and stuff, it kind of became a big deal. But we figured it out. And then we got a hotel room that was just north of the big city of Antwerp in Belgium. And so we drove over on Tuesday and then, kind of settled in there for the next week. And that drive was fun, interesting, but you know, we drove through Paris, not really anywhere near the Eiffel Tower, but drove around it much in the same way you drive around Los Angeles.
Right.
And, on that trip, we actually listened to the Richard Sacks podcast, which was
cool.
That was amazing, by the way, because he has such, I mean, he's like the history textbook for cyclocross in this country, you know, so he has so many stories and his knowledge base is just so much deeper than
yeah.
I think.
Oh, yeah. No, and I think we only like scratched the surface on that one.
Definitely
could be more.
Yeah.
So once you get to Belgium or even in France, what is the, if any, the support you're getting from USA Cycling?
This is a touchy subject because USA Cycling chooses to support who they want to, right? So anybody who goes over there and they're racing a USA Cycling kit, they're getting support from USA Cycling.
Okay,
and that's why they're wearing that kit.
Right. That was kind of what I was getting at. So you were still almost a privateer out there, but racing because you are in the U.S. and qualified.
Yes. So people like me that are on the cusp in and out of the top 50 into the 60s, 70s, if you want to go over and race a World Cup, you can, but you're pretty much on your own, right? You're going to figure it out and do it the way you want to. And I learned this because Kate Cumming had gone to race in Kogsida in October. And at that point, she was ranked, I think, just outside the top 50 as well. So for her, it was also a waiting game, trying to figure out right before the event, like whether or not she's going to be allowed to race. So I leaned on her for a lot of questions leading up to the one in France, because she had to do everything herself with her husband as well. So, you know, the logistics, the parking, where do you go, all that stuff I asked her because she had already gone through all that. And gone through it removed from the Team USA compound, I guess is what I'm trying to say, like on your own, right? And so in France and in Hoogerheide, Team USA has a parking area and they have their own setup, washing the bikes and everything. And so they have a really pro setup. And so everybody that's supported by them, you know, there's a trailer and everything. But so in France, it was much smaller. It was just, I think, a couple guys and maybe four or five girls that were racing. So the setup wasn't as big. But when we got to Hoogerheide, They had two massive trucks and the RVs and stuff because they were starting to prep for everything that they were going to need for Worlds. But yeah, so I mean, it's interesting in that, you know, Team USA is going to choose who they want to support. And if you go over there and you're still trying to figure stuff out on your own, you can maybe use their power washers if you ask nicely. Like, you know what I mean? It's like a hard, there's a fine line between like, you can just throw your stuff at them and walk away and they're going to take care of all of it versus like, you're still,
right,
you know,
right.
David needs to work on my bikes, but he needs to ask for permission and like, you know, beg a little bit, but that's the nature of the game, right? I'm still not up there where I quote unquote deserve that or not. But yeah, so that's kind of how it works over there. But the nice thing is that USA Cycling takes care of everything else in regards to registration. You know, they pick up your numbers for you. You go over there and they have everything ready for you and the parking passes and all that. Well, so it was, yeah, it was nice.
Yeah. Interesting. So what was the Hoogerheide experience? I mean, that's, you know, the France, it's almost a nice little like entry into the World Cup because it's sort of this, you know, newer race and that kind of stuff. And then you're going to basically a classic.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It was just a very nice progression. And so when we got there, I guess we were in Belgium for a few days leading up to it. And leading up to it, there's this, I don't know how to pronounce the name of the forest, but it's where Katie Compton kind of stays in the area that she trains in when she goes over to Belgium. And it's a very pretty famous forest, and there's a lot of people that train there. But it's basically the most perfect thing ever for cross bikes. So we stayed away from going to Hoogerheide at all until Saturday because we just wanted to play in this forest for the rest of the week.
That was great.
Yeah, and it was awesome. And it's funny because on one of the days, I think Thursday, we went over there and it had rained earlier in the day. So the tracks across the park were pretty fresh, you know, it's like fresh dirt. And then whoever rode later in the day, you could see the tire tracks. And there was this set of like five or six tire tracks. And one of them, I went over and was like looking at them. And one of them was slaloms, like for sure the slalom tread had gone through. And I was like, I knew it. This is where Katie was riding earlier today. And it was funny. And David was making fun of me. I was like, no, let's follow the slaloms because wherever she was riding, like it's going to be good. So we literally followed these slalom tracks to like the most awesome trails ever. But
oh, that's great.
Yeah. So yeah, fast forward to Hoogerheide, pre-riding on Saturday. Yeah. Saturday afternoon, we went over there and did some laps, and it was, I guess it was a little bit muddy, but nothing compared to what we thought was going to happen because I guess the rain going to come that night and into the next morning. Anything you were practicing on Saturday, it was going to change. You know, you're really just memorizing turns and corners and stuff, not mud and that sort of specifics. But the thing about that course, and I watched some of the replay highlight videos and stuff, and there was never a camera angle that was good enough to show the cement sand that we were riding through. And so the course obviously changed. Like everybody was saying, this is very different from years past. And one of those biggest differences was this sand mud that was like, it was literally like riding through cement.
Sure.
And so I've had a few good muddy races, right? The one in Dallas was very muddy and very thick. And this Hoogerheide race was very similar. There's like the kind of mud where it requires a lot of power to get through, a lot of focus, you know, very slow speeds is how you're racing. You know, it's nothing super fast. And, so it was very interesting. On Saturday, we were riding, and Tobin comes by and was like, have you ever been here before? And I was like, no, this is crazy. And he's like, yeah, these stairs are ridiculous. The mud is gnarly. So once he told me that, I felt a lot better because even he's saying this, you know, and he's been here before. So, yeah, I went to bed on Saturday pretty excited to race because then at this point, this is for sure my last race of the season.
Right.
Nothing matters. You know, if I get points, that's going to be awesome. I'll probably bump up a little bit more in the rankings. But yeah, so I kind of was nice just to relax a little bit mentally because nothing, you know, I was just going to go out and have fun.
Right. And that's the one thing, you know, going back to the course that, you know, Tobin was talking about that as well, is that that's the crazy thing about Hoogerheide is that they, that's just a cyclocross track. So they can do whatever they want to it. You know, they can just move earth around and do whatever they want from year to year and change it. So yeah, and those stairs looked ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess it's because there was a lot of construction that happened for the road that was right across the street from it. And that was the reason why everything changed so drastically.
Yeah.
It was like just actual city construction.
So the cement like sand that was almost before the stairs. It was like this big wide swath sort of off Cambry.
Yeah, but it was also after the stairs. Like, that's the angle I think nobody ever saw was at the top of the stairs. That stretch was so thick, and there was no good line. Like, the stuff that happened before the stairs, lines forms, you know, there was a high line that got less muddy and all that. But at the top, like, there was no way of getting through that quickly. It was just, you got to the top of the stairs after running 42 steps, and then you were going through this next 30-second section of mud that was going to require more power than anywhere else on the course.
Right.
So
you get
this huge
cardio workout climbing the stairs with your bike on your shoulder. And then the next thing you got to just that low cadence, high power through the mud.
That's
gotta be a killer.
Yeah. But it was just so awesome because very rarely did we have any courses like that all year in the US. So, It was a good experience. And even Jeremy said after the race, like, we just never had that stuff in the US this year. And he was right. Like, just nothing like that. So, it was just good even just practicing on it on Saturday and riding on it on Sunday. Like, it was just good for me to have that in the memory banks of, like, how that stuff responds and how, you know, the tires are going to hold up or not hold up. So, it was good experience. And the race was... The race start was completely uphill. Like, we started kind of at the valley of these two hills on this grid section, and as soon as the gun went off, you were going up. So I thought this was going to be good for me starting four and a half rows, if you want to call it that, because there really aren't any rows. And it gave you the opportunity for things to kind of spread out a little bit going into that first turn. And it did kind of, but again, everybody's so strong there that in the United States, it would spread out significantly if you started on a hill like that. But over there, so many people are more on the same level that going up that hill, like, it actually doesn't spread out that much. So the race started, we went around the first corner, and I don't know why they designed the course the way they did in those first two corners before the pit, but it was just like, I don't know why, it couldn't have just been a sweeping turn into the pit. They had to add these two stupid, jagged turns that just screwed it up for everybody that was outside of the top 10. So even in that video clip that you posted, it was like everybody was in my field back pretty much off their bike and running around those corners because it just jammed up so much. And in France, I was not very aggressive in the start because I was so concerned about crashing. But here, I was like, screw it. I'm going for it. I got my elbows out. I just need to move my way up. And so I had that mentality on the first lap through, like, everything. That first section through, I got through, and I was pretty far up there because I wasn't hesitant through any of the corners, I guess. It was like I was off my bike and running because I knew that was going to be the fastest.
You know, watching it was awesome seeing you up there.
Yeah, and that's what I was thinking in my head, too. I was like, this is awesome. This is, like, great start for me. And I came after the stairs, after the nasty mud, you come through, and like I told you, the start finish banners have what place I'm in, right? And I was like 24th or something crazy like that on the first lap. And I kid you not, like, I could see Katie Antineau, and she was not that far ahead of me. And I was like, this is awesome. This is going to be the best race ever. And then I just slowly blew up lap after lap. And, you know, that was probably because my fitness wasn't where it needed to be and all these other factors. But I put in, like, the most impressive first lap I could have done and just held on and went backwards a little bit, but I was pretty stoked about that. And just the fact that I was racing there and, you know, watching that course when it was the world championship race the previous year, or previous year and a half, I guess, whenever it was. That giant tree that has a sweeping 180 that goes around it. And then there's the one giant left-hand turn where, you know, in the Sven and Stibar battle, when Stibar crashed and Sven got off his bike and jumped over him, like, all these little picturesque moments on the course for me were so awesome to actually, like, be there and riding, because there are just things that, as a super fan, you're like, oh, I know this course, like, from the different camera angles and stuff, and you're racing through it, and you're like, this is where that happened. It's like, it's history.
Yeah, you know? It's almost like cyclocross cosplay, but you're actually racing.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like I'm racing. I'm not just there, like, taking in the sights. Yeah, so, I mean, all things considered, it was just a really good experience to be there and do that. And I finished 34th, so not as good as I had wanted to, but it was another sprint finish with another French girl that was, like, 18 years old. So it wasn't the same girl. It was another one. But afterwards, I was like, man, these freaking girls are so strong. But, yeah, it was a good time.
That's great. And you were able to sort of tick those, you know, off the checklist of things that you now have experience in, and just you know, definitely will help you going forward, that now next year, if, you know, hopefully you'll be able to go back and it won't be new.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's kind of where we're at now. Like, all that happened, the rankings came out the next Monday, Tuesday after, and I was 42nd. But it was like, okay, Worlds is still gonna happen, that might bump me back. But not only that, they're like 3 more weekends of racing afterwards, right? So now it's kind of just a waiting game, because I don't know what's going to happen with the selections for the North American World Cups, and whether or not the United States is actually going to get more than the top 50 to start.
So this past year, the U.S. and Vegas got double allotment. We don't know if that's happening again. And then it's also the same deal that if you're in the top 50, you're secure. If you're not, then it's going to come down to the selection. And I know you've been sort of counting points every week. So where does it stand now?
Now I'm 46th. So okay. After World Championships, I got bumped down 4 places, 2 in each of the fields. And one of those was Elle Anderson. Like, she had a great race at Worlds, and because of all the stuff that happened to her earlier in the season, her points aren't where they probably should have been. So she luckily had a great race there and moved up significantly. One of the other girls was Evie Richards, because she finished first in the U23 race, and it was awesome. So, yeah, so those were 2 of the 4 that bumped me up. But now I'm 46th, and there are 2 C1s and 1 C2 left in the calendar for February.
Yeah, but didn't Helen Wyman pretty much say she thought you were secure?
Yeah, so I'll take her word for it for now, but I'm sweating because I'm absolutely nervous.
Yeah, so a couple more weeks to wait, and then you get to concentrate on what? More gravel grinding, I take it, for the summer, and then back at it?
Yeah, that's the plan. I'm signed up for Dirty Kanza again, so I'll go back there at the end of May, and then kind of just things here and there in between I'm going to do. Luckily, in Southern California, we get like more than half of the U.S. Cup races that Scott Tedrow kind of puts on and hosts. Like, it's 3 of the 6 or whatever here. So I'm going to do those Benelli and Fontana races because I can drive to them.
Oh, great.
Yeah, and then kind of just play things by ear, and then I'll probably do the same thing as last summer, where I'll race mountain bike nationals because they're in Mammoth Mountain, California, and then start focusing on cross season from there.
Outstanding. Well, congratulations on an incredible year. It was a lot of fun to follow the season, and I'm sure we'll be talking to you again next season.
Thanks, Bill. Yeah, like I said the last time, this has been such a great opportunity, even just getting to do the race reports and having people read them. And, you know, Ben was saying people coming up to him and thanking him for his point of view and sharing his story and stuff. Like, the same thing has happened to me. And I even had people in Belgium tell me that they listened to the first podcast that I did. I was like, no way.
Oh, outstanding. That's great.
I know. And it's mind-blowing. Obviously, there's a big fan base in the United States, but when you go somewhere else like that and they tell you that they've listened to that podcast, you're like, wow, it's such a different level of fan commitment over there.
Right. But, yeah. No, that makes me happy. Yeah, That's great to hear.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. That in the first podcast that I did, I got a little bit of flack because I didn't thank my sponsors enough. when I told the story about, you know, trying so hard last summer to find people and reach out for support. I didn't actually mention any of them.
Well,
so
you should do that now.
Okay. Yeah. So obviously SDG Components, they're a SoCal based company and have been the team that I've been riding for since I started racing. I did well at one local race and they're like, you should wear this jersey and just do the rest of your season on this. And ever since then, that's who I've been riding for. So luckily SDG has believed in me from the beginning and all the sponsors in the past few years have kind of come and gone around them. But one of the second big sponsor is Muscle Monster. So they're a branch of the Monster Energy Corporation, but their big push this past year has been in the realm of protein and recovery drinks. And so what's kind of cool is that before Monster Energy was all about, you know, energy drinks and all this stuff. But at the same time, you can go into a gas station and buy something that has 20 grams of protein in it, which is new and different for them, but pretty cool that they're endorsing kind of more endurance sports, like the gravel stuff they want a big focus on and mountain biking. So if you see them in a grocery store and it's after a race, it's a pretty good option for recovery. and then Orange Seal, which is a tubeless sealant that is kind of No Tube's biggest rival, I would say. They're trying to prove that their stuff is better than No Tube's because No Tube's is more of the household brand name. But Orange Seal has a lot of points that their stuff is the best. And I've been running it actually in some of my tubulars all season without fail. So not only do they work in tubeless setups, but we've been able to put them in a couple of my tubulars that have had holes in them. But if you put it in there, they'll seal up and you can actually still keep running them, which is awesome. And then, yeah, Easton, Niner, Kogel Bearings, some of my equipment sponsors have been awesome. You probably saw pictures of my crazy helmet that I wore at Nationals.
Yeah.
That's the Cali Helmets does, you know, they have a bunch of like motor sports, downhill helmets. They're big on the full face stuff, but they also have road, and you know, more cross country, lighter weight stuff. And they came out with this new aero helmet called the Tava. And so they reached out to me and were like, we need you to wear this at Nationals. It's going to be awesome. So I did, and it's an awesome helmet. And I think more so it'll be beneficial in the longer gravel stuff. But it was kind of nice to make it a statement there for them. And Rip Van Waffles is a nutrition sponsor, and they've been actually sponsoring us for the past 2 years. And they were even at Nationals. I don't know if you saw, they had a booth set up.
Yep.
But yeah, they're probably one of my favorite like fun brands because they have such a love for cross and promoting in this discipline of cycling because of the connections to Belgium and the Netherlands and the fact that their product was just, you know, it's a Dutch thing. So they love kind of supporting cross and they even support the Richard Sachs team too. But the good news for them is that they're now in Starbucks. So any Starbucks you go to in North America, you can get a waffle. But yeah, that sums up my sponsor plugs, but
I just wanted to put
that out there.
Yep. Very good. All right, Amanda, it was great talking to you again and we'll chat soon.
All right. Thanks, Bill.
Okay. All right, and there we have it. Thanks to Amanda for joining us. You can follow her on Twitter at _Amanda_Panda_. This is tricky. And then Instagram, Amanda_Panda_. So 3 underscores on Twitter, 2 on Instagram. You can follow me at CX Hairs, and also please check out everything we got going on at cxhairs.com. rate, review on iTunes, buy stuff at the shop. I am on my way to Tokyo tomorrow to do an event for Rafa with Jeremy Powers and hang out at the Tokyo Cup for a while. So that's going to be a ton of fun. So podcast wise, hope to have something up next week. Hope to record a couple things while in Japan, but not really sure how that's going to work at this moment. So we may be taking a week off, may not. I will let you all know as soon as I know. In the meantime, thanks again for tuning in, and we will see you soon.